Good morning, Colorado. Here we go. Y'all ready for this? The Bell and Pollock Legal Show. You know the drill. Gary Bell, Brad Pollock. Our law firm is Bell and Pollock. This is a legal show, not a political show. What's on your mind today? Give us a call at 303-713-8255. That's 713-8255. In the mountains, you can call us at 970-457-1009. Anytime, on any question, on any legal subject. That's what we do here. We are injury attorneys in our day lives and our radio lives. We're here to help you solve your problems, answer your questions. 303-713-8255. Tomorrow morning, there's a new show going to air, a Bell and Pollock Legal Show, an injury show on drunk drivers and how insurance companies treat drunk drivers and the ins and outs of it. The bottom line, there are several bottom lines. One of the big ones is they don't just cave in. They don't just automatically, because there's a drunk driver, pay. Brad, let's just cover a couple of points that you covered in the show to kind of educate people about drunk driving cases.
Sure. You know, when doing some of the research and looking into it, I saw an article from a lawyer who had a blog on it that said if the at-fault party has been drunk when they were driving, it's a pretty easy case and you don't have to worry about liability. All you have to do is show they were drunk. Well, that's not necessarily true. Your case has still a lot of nuances that you have to deal with, that you have to put together. One is, where was the person drinking? The next thing was, were they visibly intoxicated? The next question was, okay, did they meet the intoxication level for a criminal case, to say they were driving under the influence, versus were they intoxicated such that they couldn't drive and you still have somebody who is under the influence but not meeting the criminal standards? You have to show causation still. You have to show the injury. You have to show they did something wrong. We can get into more detail of this, and I do on the Sunday morning show, but you know, if they didn't do anything wrong, if the drunk driver is sitting there at a stoplight and you rear-end him, don't think that you're going to necessarily be able to recover because you rear-ended a drunk driver and the person you hit was drunk driving.
Even if the drunk driver's at fault, these insurance companies and their attorneys fight vigorously on these cases, because one of the things they argue is, well, yeah, we did something wrong, so what? It didn't cause. They fight causation. They fight your damages. And so it's not a slam dunk. And it's another insurance maze that needs to be navigated. So right now we're going to talk to Martin live. Good morning, Martin. How are you?
Hi, guys.
Martin, how you doing, buddy? Hey, Martin. I've been in court all week. I'm sorry I didn't get the call back to you, buddy.
Yeah, I was brokenhearted.
There should be a country song about that, but I don't know what
I'm
it
sorry
is.
I missed the call. Now you're brokenhearted. That'd be a good
call. Yeah, that'd be a good one.
Bonded, but we've drifted.
Yeah.
What's happening, man?
Hey, I have a question on pre-existing physical ailments and whether or not they're exacerbated by an accident, and whether or not that can be used, your pre-existing ailments can be used to diminish any harm done in an accident.
Well, Martin, there's a couple things you just hit onto. That's an excellent question. Normally, the amount that has been exacerbated by the accident is the amount, and you can't diminish that or reduce the amount you're entitled to recover because you happen to have a pre-existing condition. But before you even determine if you have a pre-existing condition, you have to determine if it's really a pre-existing condition or if it's a thin skull doctrine, where actually the eggshell doctrine, we call it, but where actually was the person just more susceptible to an injury rather than the fact that you're aggravating an injury that's already there.
So if you have a pre-existing condition, you can recover if the accident made it worse. A good example is you've had a previous lumbar fusion surgery with hardware, let's say L4, L5, and you had another accident and it dismantles the hardware, it affects the hardware and or the disc, and it creates new symptoms, and you can recover for that. And so that's another surgery. So the insurance company usually tries to say, well, you had a previous low back surgery, and now you got back pain and back problem. What's your problem? Well, there's the problem.
So you're really discussing, or you're really arguing, degrees.
Well, you're arguing degrees, but it gets down to a finite level, because let's take the L4, L5 fusion. If you had it previous to the accident, did you injure a new disc? Did you injure a new nerve distribution system? And that's new, that's different, and it's worse.
And the question is, are you aggravating a pre-existing condition, or is a person just more susceptible to an injury? If I had a fusion 10 years ago, and I haven't had treatment or any kind of care for that fusion for the last 2 or 3 years, or for the last year to 2 years, then the chances are you're going to be able to be successful in arguing that the instruction that should be given is the thin skull doctrine, saying this person came to the accident in a predisposition, in a condition where this accident would cause them more harm, but you haven't aggravated a pre-existing condition because that condition was already healed. It was done.
Well, you just mentioned something about an instruction given.
Jury instruction.
Jury instruction given at trial.
Right. Yeah, go ahead.
But the thing is, on insurance companies, I'm sure the insurance companies have certain thresholds that they reach in terms of payout as to the type of injury a person sustains.
Well, they do. You know, I think quite often they even now have formulas or they have programs that they don't tell us about.
Yeah, they have a chart.
Yes, and they don't make those public. But the thing is that the first thing the insurance company has to determine is whether or not they're talking about an apportionment and whether they're talking about whether we want to see what degree of aggravation or if we want to see if this person was just in a weakened condition.
Well, then it becomes a matter of actual dollars, whether or not the insurance company wants to spend to defend as to the payout they want to offer.
Sure. But Martin, a lot of times that I don't think that dollar amount changes as far as proving the case, because they still go get one of their favorite insurance defense doctors who says, okay, I'm going to apportion some of this and I'm going to say some of this injury is caused by a pre-existing condition, and we're going to be arguing, no, none of the injury is caused by a pre-existing condition. It was that person is already entirely healed from their pre-existing condition.
Well, they can bring their expert witness all the way to the courthouse steps.
Correct.
And the plaintiff's attorneys, such as attorneys like you, would bring your expert witnesses. How many steps up the courthouse do you have to reach before they start hitting settlement talk that's realistic to the injury?
Sometimes all the way up the steps into the courtroom and through a jury verdict. I mean, I've had cases settle while the whole trial was done and the jury is out deliberating. Sometimes they just want to see if you can do it, see if you can prove it, see if you're going to do it, see what the jury's like.
But the prep work in order to even bring it up to that stage to walk into that courtroom is tremendous.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you're exactly right. And the expense.
On both sides.
The expense, the amount of money. But sometimes insurance companies want to lay down a law. They want to lay down a rule. They want to let you know how they feel about things.
And also for personal injury attorneys, they want to make sure they send a message, too, that they're not going to be rolled over on.
Right. But, you know, that comes to the fact of, okay, are you a personal injury firm or personal injury lawyers that they say, look, these guys will go to trial? If they know these guys are going to go to trial, then they say we don't have to send a message to them. They already know the message. But both sides know the message.
TV attorneys that just sit there and just throw out demand letters that really never litigate, I'm sure the insurance companies love those guys.
Well, you can bet one thing. They've got them booked. They've got them bookmarked. They know who they are. And I've heard it. I've seen it. And that's the way it works.
And their offers are much less.
They're saving the insurance companies lots of money by not really litigating.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, because the insurance company offers a lot less. On every case, and they know they're going to get it, and they're going to roll over. It happens all the time.
So really, the weak arm attorney really is doing his clients a disservice.
That's exactly correct. But I got to tell you, before we go to break, one thing I want everybody to understand real clear: if you have a pre-existing condition, you can recover. You should recover. Don't let any insurance company ever convince you that because of your pre-existing condition, you can't recover or your case is lost.
No. And I like that weak arm. I didn't miss that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, at least now we're not drifting anymore.
Hey, thanks, Martin.
Take care, buddy. I'll talk to you this week.
Okay, bye-bye. Okay.
All right, bye. The Bell and Pollock Legal Show. You can call us on any legal subject right here. We're injury attorneys, but we're ready to answer your question on any legal subject, 303-713-8255, because we are your champions of the people. back to the Bell and Pollock Legal Show. Our law firm is Bell and Pollock. We're conveniently located in Greenwood Village, I-25 and Orchard, basically. We have an office in Denver. We've got an office in Steamboat Springs. And welcome, Steamboat Springs and surrounding communities on the Western Slope. 303-713-8255. And in the mountains, you can call us at 970-457-1009. We appreciate your calls. We love your calls. We love helping you. Don't forget, if you want a free copy of our books, we have a third book out now. It's on workers' compensation. All the tips on workers' compensation, all the traps for the worker, all the traps when you're going to get caught in on workers' compensation. And in other books, don't get hurt in the same accident twice, once in the accident and again on the insurance claim. That's one book. We have another book on workers' compensation, as I just said, and we have another book on called Cowards of the Street, Hit and Run. It's everything you ever wanted to know about hit and run and insurance and crosswalks and implied crosswalks. You know, you hear those stories about pedestrians downtown Denver, other cities are walking across the street. They get hit by a car, and most people don't realize that if you're jaywalking, you're supposed to yield to the car. The car's not supposed to yield to you, and you're a pedestrian in the street. You get hit by a car, and the police officer writes you a ticket. Is there a way to go about that? Is there a way to solve that? Yes, but it becomes complicated. You can get our book, Cowards of the Street, or any of our books. Just call right here, 303-713-8255. We'll send you a hard copy. You can go on our website, championsofthepeople.com, and you can download free the ebooks on all of our books. And we got another book coming out shortly. Brad, let's talk about this this pre-existing condition situation, because we see it a lot. Insurance companies say you had a pre-existing condition, you were in an accident, therefore we're either not going to pay you or we're going to reduce your compensation a lot because you had this condition before the accident. What do you want?
Yeah, It's really a difficult concept, or it's a pretty complicated concept, believe it or not. It shouldn't be, but it is, because the law struggles with whether or not you're aggravating a pre-existing condition, where then you're looking at some kind of apportionment of how much of your current how much of your condition was made worse by the accident versus whether or not you had this more susceptibility to an accident, to injury in an accident. You were more susceptible because you have a thin skull, or because you have a thin, an eggshell type body, or because you have some kind of weakness that's more prone to be hurt because of the accident. And so, you know, the law immediately starts looking, and believe me, everybody should understand, you can recover in both circumstances the fair amount that you're entitled to recover as a result of the injury. And as a result of the negligence of another party. But the law struggles with trying to figure out how you should be classified and what considerations a jury should have. The important part is that you begin by looking at when's the last time you treated for the condition. And when you start talking about when the last time is you treated for the condition, you may then be able to solve the mystery or the riddle, but not always. Not always. I mean, you may have a condition that you get regular treatments for, but still you've been living with for all your life. You've had since you were a child. And it once again, it just makes you more susceptible to being hurt in the event you experience a trauma of some type or you're slammed into by another car.
Right. And so, you know, we have the McLaughlin case in Colorado that talks about if you're symptomatic on a pre-existing condition right up to the time of the accident, then one law applies to you. If you had a pre-existing condition and you're not symptomatic right up to the time of the accident, say you haven't had symptoms for a year or 6 months or 2 years or 10 years, then an entirely different law applies to you. It becomes complicated to navigate this insurance maze and the law surrounding pre-existing conditions. But let's explain to everybody, we keep tossing these words around, these legal words, the thin skull doctrine, eggshell doctrine, that basically means you get an instruction to the jury that you're more susceptible. You're more susceptible to injury. And the way I like to use it in trial is, you know, the insurance company wants to say that there was an intersection accident, for example, and then they hit a truckload full of steel. And, well, wait a minute, what they did was they hit a truckload full of eggs. And that's the thin skull doctrine. You're more susceptible. Eggs are more susceptible to being injured. So if you're more fragile, you're more vulnerable, you get a different jury instruction, a different law applied to you.
Sure, we talk about it all the time. If you hit the truckload full of steel, you're probably not going to have to pay much. If you hit the truckload full of eggs, you got to pay for all the eggs you broke, all of them. It doesn't matter The fact that you can say, well, I wish it would have been a truckload full of steel. So what does that mean? I wish I would have hit a car that had a bodybuilder inside who can sustain those kind of injuries, or had a football player inside who can sustain those kind of injuries. Unfortunately, I didn't. I hit a car that had a person who is not a bodybuilder, or who sustained an injury that someone might not have otherwise been harmed in the accident.
Exactly. So, you know, you take an example of a 21-year-old superstar athlete, they may not be injured. Somebody that's older or in a different physical condition could be injured, and the law recognizes that, and you get the more favorable law or more favorable jury instructions. And why do we keep talking about jury instructions? Because those are the restatement of the law. That's what's given to the jurors. Jurors have a lot of power, and I'm not sure all of them realize how much power they have. I think once they go through a trial, they realize it, but this is the law, the jury instruction. So why did we talk about jury instructions even before you file a case? Because that's the law. That's what drives the bus.
Well, it's what the jury's going to be told. But, you know, let's go back to the question of a person. You know, you hit a person who 10 years prior or 5 years prior had a hip surgery and had an artificial hip put into their body. And your accident causes that artificial hip to be damaged or to be harmed. If they haven't been receiving treatment for that hip, if they had the artificial hip put in, then you're probably looking at a thin skull doctrine. You're looking at a situation where you're saying this isn't a pre-existing condition. This is just how the person was when you ran into them.
Right.
And this is their physical makeup. This is how they are. And that's a lot different than if you're taking a person who has a hip injury and is in need of a hip surgery and has it scheduled down the road or has it scheduled for the next day. So you've got to take a look quite often at exactly what the situation is with the person, in their medical condition, in their physical condition, and what was the trauma-related event.
You can give us a call at 303-713-8255. You know, Brad, along that line, I want to talk about an old adage in our business about, and it's a law statement, it's a legal statement, and it is a current statement of the law, that the tortfeasor, and that means the wrongdoer, the one who caused the accident, the tortfeasor takes their victim, the injured person, as they find them. What does that mean? You take the tortfeasor, the wrongdoer takes the victim as they find him. It means exactly what we've been talking about here.
It does, and that's an example. You wish your victim would have been a different person.
A truckload full of steel.
Yeah, you wish it would have been a truckload full of steel, but your victim wasn't. You run into a car where your victim happened to be looking off to the side or was looking over their shoulder, and so when you ran into them, you caused the dynamics of the accident to cause their what we refer to as a whiplash effect, their acceleration and deceleration, to have different strains on their neck versus how it would have been how they'd been looking straight. You run into somebody, you run into a car where the woman is pregnant, and you wish you would have gotten someone where a woman who wasn't pregnant. Well, you take the victim as you find them, and you have to deal with the injuries that person had as they were found.
Exactly. So you've got an accident. You've got to look at the victim's circumstances. You've got to look at their medical condition. That's why it's so important that you have lawyers that do this. And you take the victim as you find them in the current condition that they are. You know, fibromyalgia. That's a good example right there, because it's a diffuse diagnosis. There's no objective really test or diagnostic test that can prove or disprove fibromyalgia, but you hurt in different parts of your body all over chronically, permanently. Then you're in a car accident and they say, well, what's the matter with you? You had this before. It was a big problem before.
And no one can predict these things. I mean, you know, we see that quite often with doctors when they start talking about medications they give. They say, okay, here's a medication. Now, if you have these symptoms, we're going to take you off the medication. If you don't have these symptoms, we're going to leave you on the medication. Well, guess what? They don't know how the medication is going to affect you. They just wait to see. It's trials, and they give you a trial sample, or they have trial and error, and they see what it does to you and how it affects you. Well, that's the same thing in a car accident. When you have these traumas and you have these forces that hit you, you look and go, we don't know how it's going to affect any given person at any given time on how they're twisted, how they're turned, what their condition is, what their medical condition is, and we only know after the accident and we start talking about what's happened to him.
Are you listening to the Bell and Pollock Legal Show? If you want a free copy of our books, just call right here at 303-713-8255. We have a new book out on workers' compensation. All the tips you'd ever want to know if you're injured on the job. All the tips in there, the traps. I think there's 15 or 20 traps, I can't remember, in there. Trap number one, trap number two. What you need to know, what you exactly need to know. You can download an ebook on our website, championsofthepeople.com, or you can call right here and get any of our books sent to you free. They are free, and they're very beneficial. We'll be right back. Welcome back. The Bell and Pollock Legal Show. This is a law talk show. We talk law here. 303-713-8255. We are injury attorneys, and we're ready to talk law with you. But right now we're going to talk to Eric from Catlin's. Good morning, Eric.
Good morning. How are you doing today?
How you doing, buddy?
What's cooking?
Doing good. Thank you. Listen, I'm going to go through our last week of specials for this week. We're doing the breakfast quesadilla for breakfast special. It's 2 6-inch flour tortillas with a couple scrambled eggs. You get your choice of ham, bacon, or sausage. That comes with lettuce, tomato, guac, and sour on the side. That's going to be the breakfast special all week. And then, like I said, the last week of the specials for lunch is going to be a blue cheeseburger. That's a six-ounce Angus burger cooked to the temperature of your choice. You're going to load that up with blue cheese crumbles. You can get our waffle fries or our homemade chips for $1 extra on that. That's going to be the lunch special all week. And don't forget on Mondays and Fridays from 11 to 2. It's all-you-can-eat taco and burrito buffet. It's all-you-can-eat. It's only $7.99. That actually includes a non-alcoholic beverage in the price. And something I've been thinking to mention to you guys, but I keep forgetting to tell you, we actually have a punch card program here where you come in, you get your card punched, and you get 10 purchases of entrees. You get the 11th one free, so don't forget about that. We have a ton of those going on. Come in and check us out and see all the other things we have to offer.
Okay, Eric, where are you located?
4379 East Mississippi Avenue. That's one block east of Colorado Boulevard. That's the Glendale Shopping Center.
I know you're loaded down there. Tell everybody hi, all the customers hi.
You got it. Shall do.
Have a good one, Eric.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks. Thank you. The Bell and Pollock Legal Show. We talk law, and we're going to talk law with Steve right now. Good morning, Steve. Welcome to Bell and Pollock.
Well, hi, Gary, and hi, Brad.
Hi, Steve.
It looks like you got an echo.
It's been a while since I talked to you.
Maybe you got to turn your radio down.
And, I was going to go to law school and so forth. So.
There's an echo. You got to. Okay. All right.
What you doing, Steve? Hello.
All right. Maybe we lost Steve. I'm not quite sure.
Steve, call us back, buddy. We lost you.
Yeah, we did. All right, we're going to talk a lot with Patrick. Good morning, Patrick. How are you? Patrick, you're not there either.
Yes, I am.
Oh, how you doing, buddy?
How you doing, man?
Good morning, gentlemen. Hey, I like your lead-in music with the James Gang there. That's excellent.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. You ought to see me play air guitar. I'm pretty good at that.
Yeah, I'd like to see that.
Yeah.
Hey, I've got an issue with paying a bill I'd like your opinion on. My wife had open heart surgery on November the 10th, quite extensive.
Wow.
We have excessive medical bills and some reduced income. And most people that I've called have been very willing to work with us on making payments on the bills. But the anesthesiologist, I just got their bill earlier in the week. And I called them, and the bill's $1,200. It's not excessive. And I just said, I'd like to pay you, you know, make a $100 a month payment over the next year, and we'll get you paid off. And, you know, explain that we only have her hospital bill is almost $300,000.
Whoa. Yeah, goodness gracious.
Yeah, we do have insurance, but the insurance pays 90%. And so anyway, to make a long story short, they said we won't accept $100 a month. That we, and a very nice lady.
Right.
And she's just doing her job. We'll only set it up for 6 months. And I said, I just can't do it in 6 months. And so what they said they wanted, well, if you'll send us a letter why you can't pay us in 6 months, send us your last 2 years of income tax returns and your banking records for the last 3 months, then maybe we'll let you slide and do it, extend it.
Let me pick myself up off the floor, okay?
Yeah, me too.
You are kidding me. Was this the anesthesiologist's office, or was this a collection agency?
No, this is the anesthesiologist's office. As I said, we just got the bill this week. And I call him. My wife and I have a plus 800 credit rating. My credit's extremely important to me, and I'm trying to pay. But is there some liability or something they can turn into a collection agency if I just send them $100 a month? I mean, doesn't that seem like a reasonable thing to do?
Well, I know Brad's got his take on this, but under no circumstances should you or are you required to send any financial information, any bank statements, any tax returns, or anything else, period.
Yeah, I'd be very careful about that, because what they're setting you up for is to say, well, now we decided we're not going to do it, now we're going to sue you, and we know where all your assets are, we know what your income is, we know everything about you, and we can go collect it on a lawsuit, which will destroy your credit rating right there.
Well, and I told this nice woman who just works for the company that's totally unacceptable. That's not something that I will do.
Correct.
Right.
And I said, it's ridiculous. I didn't sign a contract. I'll pay in a certain amount of time for my wife.
Right.
We didn't sign anything like that. But I guess my main question is, if I send them $100 a month, would they turn this over to collections by the time it went to court or did anything?
Well, you never know on any given entity. Okay. First of all, I presume this $1,200 is actually after you got your explanation of benefits.
Absolutely. Oh, and 90% was paid.
Okay.
By the insurance. So they have got that money.
So, you know, they got 90%, which means they got well over $9,000-$10,000. They got $1,200 left. I would start paying them $100 a month.
Correct.
If you'd like us to get involved to help you with negotiating the $100 a month, we'll be happy to do that. Sometimes we do send letters explaining the fact that this was an open heart surgery, and this is all the bills you've got, and this was the insurance coverage, and here's the OBs, here's all that we've got. I want to tell you that we've been successful in our office that when we have these type things turned over to collection and they turned over to harm your credit rating, we've been successful in getting those taken off.
Yeah.
By the fact that you pay them, and we identify the fact this was as a result of a health condition, and it doesn't show your responsibility. It just showed that you had the bill. So we're happy to work with you and contact this person and talk to him if you'd like us to.
Well, what do you think, guys?
Well, here's what I think. You ought to let us give it a shot for you, but you're between the old proverbial rock and hard spot, because the money's owed. They're not, you know, they're probably being unreasonable, but they can do what they want. If I were you, I would send in the $100 a month with a letter that says that I plan to pay you $100 a month, and pay the $100 a month.
Yeah,
that's what I would do. And if you want us to jump in the fray, make a call or whatever we need to do. Sometimes when they hear from attorneys, it's a little bit different flavor, and we'll be glad to help you. But if we don't help you, you can help yourself, I think, by send them a letter, say I can pay you $100 a month, and I'm going to, and here's the first $100 payment.
And you make a great point, Patrick, when you say you don't have a contract with them as far as how soon you're going to pay them.
Correct.
You know, you went in for the medical care. The medical care was rendered. There's no contract saying you have to pay within 30 days or 60 days. They can say when it's due. But yeah. If you don't have the money and you're sending it, I mean, you're so rare. I mean, you know, we get a lot of people calling up saying we don't want to pay it at all, or we can't pay it at all. You're saying, look, I'll pay you $100 a month.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to pay the bill. Hey, we owe the bill. I don't have any issue whatsoever with paying it, I will pay it. But it just struck me so much that you can be so unreasonable to say, we won't accept that, and we want all this information in order to allow you to wait a longer period of time to pay it.
Well, give it a try, and I'm going to put you on hold, give Kevin your information, do what we said, and if you want us to give a try for you, we're more than happy to do it, because we help a lot of people that way.
Well, thanks, guys. Been listening to you for years. I picked up a lot of great information over the years. So much appreciate what you do.
Thanks, Patrick.
Have a great new year, okay?
We'll negotiate that one for you.
Same to you, Patrick. Okay, the Bell and Pollock Legal Show, Gary Bell, Brad Pollock. This is a Law Talk show. We've got Steve back online. Good morning, Steve.
Yeah, Gary and Brad, I lost you there. But I have a very unique case here of a young fellow named David I discovered this past week. And it's very sad. He was run over as a kid. He lost both his legs when he was run over and damaged and all that.
Right.
But the ambulance chasers chased his mother and him into the hospital. And what happened was he was unconscious. And What happened was the dirties, you know, the lawyers, whatever, ran into the hospital and tell her to sign these papers so they could help him. And it was not true. And he's been suffering now for quite a while, paying off these bills for his legs, and he has a child, and all he does is work, and he's got rods in his legs.
Right.
He's got everything, and the insurance company just walked away. And he thought that he could never get any help again, and he's paying these bills out of his pocket trying to buy work. And I hope he's listening to you today, because we did try to contact you guys during the week.
Right.
And I tell him he needed help, and he needed to talk to you guys.
Steve, how old is this guy?
I believe he's 29.
Okay.
When did this happen?
Quite a while ago. He was a young boy, and I was worried about statute of limitations, but there's a lot of fraud involved in this thing.
Right, right. Well, okay, so we'd be glad to jump in and try to analyze the whole situation, but he was hit by a car, a vehicle?
He was run over.
Run over.
He ran over his legs and his body. They rushed him to the hospital. When they did, the insurance company followed right behind. And then what happened was he was unconscious in the room, you know, in the hospital, and the lawyer boys
right.
Run in there and got his mother to sign the paperwork so they could help him, and it was not true.
Something doesn't sound right to me. This is going to need some investigation. Listen, we got to go to break, but I'm going to put you on hold. Please give Kevin your information. This bears a little bit of investigation. We'll be glad to help, okay?
Okay, thanks.
Thanks for the call. Bell and Pollock Legal Show. If you want a free copy of our books, any of our books, we got a new one out on workers' compensation. It's the definitive guideline. It has all the tips, all the traps you can fall into. You want to know about them, and you don't want to fall into them. Also, our book, Cowards of the Street, Hit and Run. And the last half of the book shows you all kinds of insurance information with step-by-step procedures on how you can protect yourself from either a hit and run or from a person that doesn't have enough insurance. Call right here, 303-713-8255, and we'll take care of you. We'll be right back. Law Talk. We talk law on the show. We are injury attorneys in our day lives, in our radio lives. We're simply here to help you. 303-713-8255. If you want copies of any of our books, and we got a new one out on workers' comp, you know, the other one's Cowards of the Street, Hit and Run, and the other one, Don't Get Hurt Twice in the Same Accident, Once in the Accident, and again on the insurance claim. We're going to talk law with Bill. Good morning, Bill. Welcome to Bell and Pollock.
Well, thank you for taking the call.
You're welcome.
I had two questions, but that last gentleman just brought up another one, too.
Okay.
The guy that got run over by the car?
Yes.
If he was jaywalking, would the situation have been different?
Okay, let me address that.
Absolutely
it would be different because the pedestrian is supposed to yield to the car. And it sounds weird, but that's what it is. And then you get into local ordinances. But then let's talk about crosswalks. You got to be in the crosswalk. You have to be in the crosswalk. But then we have the case where you cross the street where you're supposed to, from the curb or the corner to the other side, and there's no crosswalk painted. And that's called the implied crosswalk, and that changes the whole law. Get our book, Cowards of the Street, Hit and Run, and all the answers are right there. But you asked a great question.
And finally, depending on the age of the young boy when he got hit, none of that may apply, because if he's certain ages, then they're not required to be within the crosswalks.
Right.
That changes the whole rule. So there's a lot of nuances to that.
Can you charge somebody that's 4 years old with negligence? Can you charge somebody 8 years old with negligence? All those questions. But great question, Bill.
Okay, second one. I do have a third one. Second one is, if I cause an accident, is my liability different if the person in the other car that was injured was wearing a seatbelt or not?
You bet.
You betcha.
If the person is in the other car was not wearing a seatbelt, now we're talking front seat drivers. If they were not wearing a seatbelt, then what they can recover is going to be diminished. They're going to not be able to recover as much from you.
So this is where contributory negligence comes in? Or
well, there's a stat. Yes, that's true. Comparative negligence in Colorado. You compare the negligence of the people involved in the accident, if you will. And then there's a seatbelt statute that says you must wear your seatbelt if you're in the front seat. You do not have to wear your seatbelt in the back seat. And if you don't have it on in the front seat, then it's a complicated formula of how you get your damages reduced. Okay, so if they're not wearing their seatbelt, you get your damages reduced. It doesn't mean that's the end of the case for them at all, but they get their damages mitigated.
And I want to tell you something else. Even as you're getting the damages reduced, there's certain elements of damages you can't even ask for. But the biggest part is also juries don't like that. Quite often, a jury will give you less even when the instruction's not there because they feel you should have been wearing your seatbelt. I can't tell you how many times one of the first questions the jury wants to know is, was the injured party wearing their seatbelt?
Exactly.
Very good. The last one deals with basically if you're a defendant, and this is more from watching television than anything else, in a criminal trial.
Sure.
But ordinarily, I get the impression that the lawyer will advise the defendant not to volunteer any information.
Okay, so that's the Fifth Amendment of the United States Constitution of the right. The right to not self-incriminate yourself, period. You can remain silent in the courtroom. They have the burden to prove the prosecution. And Brad knows a lot about this as well. But I will say to you, if the defense lawyer makes the decision to put the charge, the accused on the stand, then it's all fair game from there.
Okay, now that's where my question really comes up. Because the oath is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. But my question is about the whole truth. That implies to me that you should be volunteering information.
That's an interesting question because the bottom line is that oath itself is all subject to whether or not you're violating your Fifth Amendment rights. And you can sit there and when you're being asked questions, say, I choose not to answer that. And I'm going to exercise my Fifth Amendment rights on the grounds that might incriminate me. And you don't have to answer the question at all. Now, once, you know, the trump card that can be played is they can give you immunity. And they can give you immunity for what you say as it applies to either what you say or to the entire question of the crime itself. But the oath has a different situation when you're dealing with the Fifth Amendment. And finally, what most judges are going to tell you is answer the question. And that's what the advice is always given to anybody who's on the witness stand is answer the question. Don't go off trying to give more information than what's been asked, because the bottom line is that's all you're supposed to do.
So, so here are the permutations of that, Bill. First of all, you got the choice not to even get on the stand at all. They can't ask you any question whatsoever. Some states have, if you get on the stand, have selective Fifth Amendment application, meaning you can choose your question. You can answer question number one, but not answer questions two, three, and four, etc. And then some states have the all-inclusive. If you testify as to anything, you've got to testify as the answers to all questions. But that's generally how it works.
Well, I'm really confused though, because it seems to me like that if the prosecutor would say, "You've already taken the oath. You're on the stand, okay?"
Right.
And the oath says you have the whole truth, okay? And what if the prosecutor says, "What happened?"
Well, okay, so if they say what happened, and then the defendant's going to have their story. The story is that I didn't intentionally try to injure anybody. This was an accident. I had no intent to commit a crime. I had no intent to do this, to do that, or I didn't do it, or I wasn't there. And so it might be the whole truth to them. They have their own defense. But yeah, that's a great question. If they said what happened, they get the right to say what happened. Maybe it's not going to agree with the prosecution, but they're going to say it.
But then can they be guilty of... What's the term if you testify wrong?
Perjury.
Perjury, yeah.
Well, they can, but you got to prove that it's absolutely wrong and they intentionally lied about it. But sure, of course they can.
Okay, that's my question. Because it seems to me like that have the oath having that whole truth in there is a lot different than what we ordinarily consider it.
Well, that's a great question, and it is the oath. You know, you've seen it exercised in Congress. The Congress subpoenas people, and they ask them questions. They choose to not answer that question. Yeah, all that stuff. Yeah.
I wasn't thinking about the Fifth Amendment when I asked the question.
Right.
I was thinking basically about just if the prosecutor says what happened, and I just don't know why we don't do that all the time, just have the prosecutor ask the defendant what happened.
I think they do, but most of the time they don't even take the stand, Bill. You can't ask them. Yeah, they have the right not to even get up there and testify. So.
Now, what if it's a witness?
Well, a witness is different.
That's different.
A witness has to tell what happened. You know, now, a lot of times, if I'm on the defense, I'm objecting, saying this is, the question's not specific enough. And I'm saying, you know, they've got to ask specific questions.
Well, that's the question. If you're supposed to tell the whole truth, you're hoping they don't ask the wrong question.
Okay? Well, that's true. The whole truth but the truth.
That's not in the spirit of the whole truth, then.
Well, you're arguing the position that the person is not telling the truth. That they're up there telling a different story. They've been accused, and maybe what they're saying is the truth. If they're not, if they're lying, that's perjury. Bottom line.
It just seems like that's not the way it ordinarily works out, though. That they don't usually ask the question, "Well, what happened?"
I see what you're saying. Well, if they take the stand, they can certainly ask it.
They don't ask that question because they don't want an open-ended answer.
Well, because, when you ask a question, you should know the answer ahead of time.
That's right.
Hey, Bill, we are up against the wall in time, so we appreciate your call.
Thank you very much.
All right, and Beth, I'm sorry we couldn't get to you. Please give Kevin your information. I'll give you a call this week myself. I'm sorry that you had to hold so long. We were very busy this morning, but I'm glad to be answering your settlement question. You can call us anytime. Don't forget our website, championsofthepeople.com. Don't forget, if you want a free auto accident assistance packet, just call here, email our law firm, call us. If you want hard copies of our books, call Kevin right here and tell him. Or you can go to our website, championsofthepeople.com, and download ebooks for free. They're all right there. We love helping people. We'll see you next week. It's the simple things in life.